Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very excited for this week's show. It is our annual wind-up of the summer in movies, the summer 2019. So I am joined, as always, for this annual podcast by JB.
Could we postpone this? I'm still in line for Avengers Endgame.
And Adam Risky.
I'm still in line for Where Did You Go, Bernadette?
We're going to be talking about the summer that was. We're defining the summer as having begun with Avengers Endgame, even though it was April. It really did kind of kick off this movie summer. So let's get into it. Jay Bones, you have a thesis about this summer.
I thought this summer was terrific. And I don't think it's just because I'm retired and I get to go out to more movies. I'm thinking about previous summers, and I'm looking at the movies this summer that I really, really liked, and there's more of them than usual.
How about you, Adam?
There's two that I loved and a bunch that I liked, but even the ones that I liked didn't really stick with me all that much. So it seems like a big outliers. Those are the ones I remember. There's like three that are all so bad, and then there's two that are amazing, and then everything else is kind of in the middle.
I think I might be closer to you, but I did not see as much as either of you.
But I thought there was a lot to love. I'm curious now about what you hated, because there were three real stinkers this summer. And I have a feeling that one of my stinkers will perhaps be controversial just based on what I've read on the social media machine.
Oh, interesting.
I'm excited.
I know
seem to not. I remember when you went and you were like, I didn't mind it. Or maybe you just didn't want to get into an argument, so you were downplaying how much you loved it, because I think it might have been my most anticipated movie of the year.
Okay.
You want to just talk about it?
Sure. We'll go out of order a little bit.
It's a little film called The Dead Don't Die.
Oh, yeah.
And I was so looking forward to it, if only for the cast.
I forgot that
trailer.
Came out.
Okay, this is important. This is an important
thing.
That's
going to be the
theme
for the summer, because I can't believe some of the stuff that came out in the summer that I would swear came out in January.
That came out, I think I saw it the night it opened, or pretty close. That came out at the beginning of June. And I'm a big Jim Jarmusch fan, and my God, the cast he assembled. And it's just...
I wasn't a big fan.
I get that that's part of the joke.
Right.
But, spoiler alert for The Dead Don't Die. Is that okay?
Sure, yeah.
You raised your eyebrows.
No, I'm just fast forward a few seconds or minutes if you don't want to hear spoilers for The Dead Don't
Die. Yeah, and it's not spoilers, because there's no reason for you to see the movie. The minute Adam Driver says he's seen the script...
Yeah. I saw it. I didn't think that it was any worse than, say, Land of the Dead or Survival of the Dead or Diary of the Dead. So I thought
one of those I have affection for, the one I saw with you.
Yeah.
Oh, and
Diary of the Dead.
And everyone else.
You're a monster.
I think Doug was with us that day.
No, he
and
wasn't.
Everyone else was shaking their head and like, oh, JB, you just...
I agree, the fourth wall breaking,
like Land of the Dead,
is... And I when I say that, they're all kind of okay for me.
Okay.
Like, the Dead Don't Die, I thought the score was good, and I thought the atmosphere was good, and it made me annoyed that they just weren't playing it straight, because I thought the atmosphere was actually pretty good for a zombie movie.
I agree with you there.
But then when you talk about, you know, the fourth wall breaking and everything, other than the cast and for Jim Jarmusch, who is that for? Like, you're basically just kind of making fun of your audience at that point for watching a movie and taking it seriously or being invested in it at all.
And I agree with what you said about the score, but what really annoyed me was how many times they played that damn song over and over.
Yeah.
The whole movie seemed to be some sort of promotional item.
Well, they think that's such a funny joke, and it's really not. So,
no. Yeah. Once again, Tilda Swinton seems to be in a completely separate movie of her own that they edited in. And let's all remember that every time Tilda Swinton finishes a film, she puts on a wedding dress and walks into the ocean. So that was really, really disappointing, because except for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, The Dead Don't Die was honestly the movie I was most looking forward to this year.
I thought the summer started pretty strong because I liked Avengers Endgame as those big blockbusters go. I thought that was a pretty good one.
Yeah.
We had the one with Seth Rogen and Charlize Long Shot I thought was good. We had John Wick 3. The first four or five that I saw this summer, with the exception of Aladdin. Aladdin is one of those movies that you should put in a time capsule so you could show everything that's wrong with blockbuster movies right now. And I haven't seen Lion King, but my understanding is Lion King is very similar in that way.
Oh, we'll get into Lion King.
Okay.
I need minutes for that one.
I have completely avoided every one of those because I have such an amount of affection for the cartoons because I saw them originally with Jake. And someone just posted on Twitter, my God, it made me laugh. They said that a scene from the new live action, let's put quotations around live action, Lady and the Tramp had snuck out, that it had been released against Disney's wishes. And the person posted a video they took of a dog eating a tremendous amount of spaghetti off the ground and then immediately throwing it back up. And then they did the GIF, so it just kept repeating.
I saw a joke for the new Lady and the Tramp where they showed the poster and they're like, leave it to Hollywood to cast a dog, a male dog that looks like he's 57 and a female dog that looks like she's 18.
So I agree with Patrick's point that the summer started strong.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Exactly those movies, except for a whole bunch of reissues that I saw, that between Avengers Endgame and John Wick, I saw Batman Returns, Fathom Event, A Star is Born with Judy Garland, Fathom Event, and then Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, which was a Critics Classics at Elk Grove, which you also attended.
It did.
Go back. You remember.
That's another way. Yeah, that feels like 2 years ago.
But
it kind of happens in May.
Avengers Endgame, John Wick 3, Long Shot, and then Booksmart.
Oh, yeah,
It was a nice. But between those, there was a film I think I've seen that I don't think either of you have seen. My wife dragged me to this because she's a big fan of the Lord of the Rings books.
Oh, no, I did not see that movie.
Tolkien. And it is as bad as the day is long.
Yeah.
It looks like it was made with good intentions, but the entire film is, oh, this is him before he was him, and he went off to fight in the war. And during the war, you're like, oh, it's like you're shopping at Spirit Halloween Superstore. That's where he got the idea for the orcs, and that's where he got, oh, the men are in a fellowship. And the script even does this. We're a fellowship now. Ring the bell. You know, just nonsense and ridiculousness, and it's as bad as the day is long.
How is that biopic still being made in 2019? Like, that version of a biopic?
We've had so many that sort of go off in different directions and are more successful that don't take the standard. This all comes back to the Patton Oswalt routine about Paul McCartney looking in the guitar shop window and saying, I want that guitar. And then you're like, oh, because he becomes Paul McCartney of the Beatles. It's awful. Avoid it at all costs. It's so bad. And
consider it done.
Oh,
no one loves The Lord of the Rings more than my wife, and she didn't like it either.
When you mentioned the how is this type of biopic still being made, that reminded me during the week this week, I won't say which movie, but I was in a theater watching a movie, and there's the scene where the guy gives the important speech, and then his dad comes in the back. Like, just in the last minute to hear the speech.
Right.
And I basically wanted to throw, like, every article of my clothes at the screen and chairs and employees where I'm just like, do you know what's happening in Theater 5 right now?
Movies informed only by cliches from other movies.
Yeah.
Speaking of getting angry at bad movies, excuse me. My favorite tweet of yours for the entire summer was,
you've been keeping track? What's the? I need to see the list.
No, I just, because this one stuck in my mind because it was so great.
Oh.
That Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is so great that it made you want to punch the fucking Lion King poster.
No, I said, no, it's not quite that. I appreciate you loving the tweet, but you misremembered it. No, it's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is so good that when I walked out of the theater at Marcus Addison and saw the poster for the Lion King, I said, fuck you, to the to a poster.
Notice that I add the violence. That's the gloss that I put on it.
Yeah, no, not a violent dude. No. Snarf. Yeah.
The actual tweet is funnier than what I said.
My favorite part of the new Lion King is when Mufasa's hanging over the cliff and Scar, like, grabs his paws and then he goes, help me up, brother. And he's just like, we're going to make so much money. That's the best part of the whole movie.
Scar just starts making it rain.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was fortunate because I was out of town when the Lion King came out. I would have seen it with my children, but my mom took my kids, so they got to see it, and I didn't have to. But that's the reason I saw Aladdin. That's the reason I've seen a couple of the things that I've seen, because I have kids. Yeah. Otherwise, I would skip those movies.
The Lion King has made over $1 billion worldwide, and there's, like, no cultural paw print
nice.
To any of it.
Thank you. Is it that parents have affection for it because they grew up with it, and they want to take their kids? And the score is great. If you're just going to hear those songs because you like that song, those
songs.
Do
they do all the songs?
I mean, sort of.
I
like...
thought that was part of the whole Beauty and the Beast mystique, that they took this beloved cartoon and they sort of turned it into a Broadway musical in a movie. That if you like the
Aladdin
score...
is, I think, I mean, I didn't like Aladdin, but Aladdin at least felt like you're watching the Aladdin show at Disney World.
That's exactly what it felt like.
Or like you're watching A Christmas Story live.
Right. That's exactly
because
what it
felt
like.
Because the other thing I thought about these Disney, let's call them remakes, is that before home video, Disney used to re-release their classic films on a schedule every 8 years. Mm-hmm. Because every 8 years you have a new crop of kids. And that was great because I wish they still did that because I like to see them in the theater. Is this their twisted way of doing that? Because with home video you can't release the original film, so this is sort of a weird value added reissue.
Yeah, except this time they get to make $1 billion with it, as opposed to maybe an extra $40 million that they might make if they reissued it.
And again, I haven't seen any of them, so I'm intentionally ignorant, but these films are expensive to make, right?
Because I'm sure Lion King was.
Yeah.
Aladdin, too.
The thing that's frustrating is they're getting rewarded most for the laziest ones, whereas if you look at Mary Poppins Returns or Dumbo, say what you want about those two movies, they're at least doing like a remake slash sequel, so there's a little bit more new material.
Mary Poppins Returns is really, really
good. And the more I get away from Dumbo, which is a movie I liked, the more I like it, to the point where I'm just like, do I need to rewatch this at the end of the year? And that's just because of how shitty this year's been, I think. But I know we disagree on that point, but I don't think this year's very good. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's just frustrating because with The Lion King, it became this weird game of me watching it. I'm like, how are they going to fuck up this scene? and then it happens, and then they did. And I was just like, what?
Was it in the way you expected, or did they find new ways to fuck it up?
No, like new ways. It was strange.
That's almost interesting.
I beg to differ because I experienced it rather than we're talking
true,
about
true.
It.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Help me out here because when Beauty and the Beast came out, the remake, and made so much money, again, I thought, well, people wanted to see it live action. But let's put quotation marks around live action, because the thing I couldn't figure out about Lion King is it's talking animals.
Yes.
So they didn't train a bunch of animals they didn't put peanut butter on the roofs of the animals' mouths. No. And then it's CGI.
Yeah, but somehow it looks... It looks worse than it did when it was, like, in 95 when they did Babe. Like, that looked more realistic.
Because those are real animals.
What? Oh, were they real animals and then they just... I thought they were... Yeah. Or maybe they were or practical effects or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's weird. Like, when you see in The Lion King, like, they're speaking or singing or anything like that, it's just the same. There's no expression to any of the faces because they're trying so hard to convince you that these animated CGI animals are real animals, so there's no emotion. The thing that's weird about it is like everything feels disconnected. It's almost like the whole movie's being read as a storybook.
Well, that's the
weird.
The deadening effect of people wanting things to be realistic.
Right.
And like you said, well, we can't have Pumbaa make a funny face because
lions don't make funny faces.
Right. But
he's not a lion. Sorry.
And this will be this will be the last time I reference Twitter. When Lion King came out, someone did a split screen of Hakuna Matata.
That was invaluable.
Between the original animated version and the new version. And the original animated version, which is beloved, is full of business. There's all these things happening that the animators worked out. Like, he jumps in the air and lands in the water and then shakes off the water. And there's all this. And, of course, they're all making faces because it's a cartoon. And then on the other side of the split screen, there's the Hakuna Matata from the new version. And it is just, they're walking through the jungle.
Yeah.
It's and there's no.
$1 billion.
It's my least favorite movie of the summer just because I think it's really problematic what it represents.
Yeah.
And it makes me
so
mad.
It's so successful that it sends all the wrong messages.
But yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what I meant. After it was over, this just shows you like the intelligence of, you know, people. I'm sitting in the theater and the credits are ending and like I hated the experience with every fiber of my being, and then on the right is like a young boy and he's dancing because they're playing the music that he likes. I'm just like, okay, well, it makes sense. I guess it worked for him. He maybe has never even seen the animated Lion King. So right next to me was a couple. They were probably like in their 20s, and the girl goes, well, that was really good. It wasn't as good as the original, but that was really good. And then the guy with her goes, I haven't even seen the original. And I'm just like, this is who this movie's made for. It's for, like, people who just, I'm at the movies nonstop. That's it.
Yesterday, we were in line behind a young couple, their baby daughter. The wife was pregnant, very pregnant, with their next child and one of their mothers. So it's the whole nuclear family. And I don't know what they asked for a ticket for. Because, you know, with choosing the seats and everything, the ticket line takes way longer now than it used to. And you get, okay, it's not difficult, just that they were asking for tickets to something rated R. And the ticket taker, who was taking his job way too seriously, wanted to see ID for the pregnant mom that he had somehow deduced.
God.
That she was not old enough.
Mm-hmm.
Although another person in the party was one of their moms, so Jan turned to me and said, but isn't the rule...
Right.
Yeah.
As long as one of them is 17.
So I thought, clearly this baby belongs to her, and she's ready to go with the second one. She was very, very pregnant. Doesn't that supersede being old enough?
You'd think so.
But then I thought, how on earth could anyone think that someone in that situation wasn't old enough for an R-rated movie? So then I started to think it was that show your ID for the A-list thing?
Maybe. Yeah, I don't know.
You know, you've experienced this. Oh, they're cracking down.
Maybe this ticket guy was just like gatekeeping Brian Banks for himself.
Which could have been, because...
Is that R?
It's out.
For whatever reason, this prevented them from seeing the movie they wanted to see.
Oh, for real?
So right there, he says, well, what else is there?
Oh,
and now I'm going to stand behind four people, one of whom is a baby. She can't read yet.
It's the Taco Bell menu. You're like, this is going to take 20 minutes.
Right.
So they finally decided to see Dora the Explorer, which it was just so utterly weird.
Yeah.
But that made me think what you said, that we take for granted that everyone has seen as many movies as we have.
Yeah.
Also, I keep wondering why Dora is so much older in this live-action version.
I think that's the joke. It's like the Brady Bunch movie type of gambit.
Oh, so it's self-referential.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, like, we know Dora's not hip, and us knowing that is what makes this hip.
Oh, boy.
I think there's also a cartoon where she is older.
Dora, SNL, the teenage years or something. SNL once did a parody.
Yeah.
That was
very funny.
Because I had never seen Dora the Explorer, but apparently in an effort to get kids up off the couch, she would often ask the children at home to do and say things.
Right.
And that's what SNL was making
fun
of.
It was very funny.
Do it!
Do you know who my parents are?
And then at some point this year, you asked us what our favorite movie of the year so far was.
Okay.
And luckily, this request came after June 3rd.
Okay.
Because I wrote a little thing about Rocket Man.
Yes.
Which I'm still a
That
big
came out
fan
this
of.
Summer.
It did.
Yes, it did.
Was this summer 8 years long?
Yeah.
Is every summer? I feel like we do this every summer where it's just like, I can't believe that was this same year.
I think Patrick was busy this summer.
No, that was Elton John.
I was busy having asthma.
He was busy practicing breathing exercises.
I actually wound up seeing it again because the first time I saw it was without my lovely wife. So I went back to see it again. And although I didn't like it quite as much the second time and my quibbles became a little louder, it's still a real good movie. And I remember when Patrick first saw it.
Yes.
Your comment was, you can, and I'm going to screw this one up just like
That's okay.
Adam's
I won't remember
tweet,
what I said.
That you can sit through Rocket Man, and the whole time you could say, Bohemian Rhapsody could have been this.
Yeah.
If they had just gone with that director for the whole time. Actually having the character sing, actually making it more like a Broadway musical, I thought was really smart. I haven't seen it yet, but if you watch it on demand, it's expanded. The version on demand is expanded, and I've heard some of the musical numbers are longer.
Mm-hmm. Now with more parental disapproval. I could care less about Oscars. This is well established. But Rocketman won't really even be a part of the conversation, I'm guessing, because, as we said, it has made no cultural paw print.
Yeah. It came out in May.
Right.
Well,
but the irony is that Rami Malek wins for lip-syncing
for
Freddie
karaoke.
Mercury, and Taron Egerton gives a really good performance as Elton John and does all his own singing and won't even be considered.
Which is the opposite of what usually happens. Usually the Oscars gets it wrong. I'm thinking of all the songs in Saturday Night Fever. And then the next year, they make up for it because the Oscars are a lot of things, but they're not hip. It takes them a year to catch up.
Right.
So the year after Saturday Night Fever, they give Best Song to Last Dance from Thank God It's Friday.
Yeah.
That's true. That actually
is. Yeah.
I liked Rocket Man a lot more than I thought I would, too. I liked that. I mean, when you have a movie that's basically melodrama and it works, it can be pretty nice, and that's what I thought happened with this one. And then also, it was nice to see Taron Egerton be given like a different kind of role.
Yeah,
I missed Eddie the Eagle, but so maybe that was kind of like
everyone.
This. But I was getting burnt out on his Kingsman. That's why I didn't see, like, one of the many reasons why I didn't see Robin Hood, where I'm just like, I'm done
there
with
There were so many reasons not to see Robin Hood.
But you know what I mean? It's
Don't
just
make
like
me pick
he was,
one.
He's the same kind of, like, sly dog.
And I think I'd like, only, I yeah. still haven't seen the Kingsman sequel, so I've only ever seen him in the first Kingsman.
Okay, yeah.
The first time I saw Rocket Man, I thought it was so cool because I had forgotten that Elton John had this Beatles connection. Because the guy who ended up signing Elton John for his publishing was Dick James, who at that point you think would have retired because Dick James signed the Beatles originally, and he administered all their songwriting royalties and publishing rights, and he got independently wealthy over that. And the actor who plays Dick James in Rocket Man, I just sat there, and I'm like, I've seen him before. Who is that? Who is that? Who is that? Because he had this... the feeling that the actor playing Dick James was sort of playing him like a gangster. And eventually I looked it up, and that actor played Al Capone on Boardwalk Empire.
Oh, I've never seen Boardwalk Empire.
He was in Snatch also.
I've seen Snatch.
Yeah. He was the guy who was with Jason Statham in Snatch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I remember him.
Yeah. It's a fun performance. I like it.
Yeah.
It's a good movie.
He was a very good Dick James.
From Guy Ritchie, director of Aladdin.
Yeah.
See how it all comes back
The good thing is Aladdin made a lot more money, so Guy Ritchie will get more chances.
Blank check Guy Ritchie movies is what we have to look forward to now.
Yeah, we get Sherlock Holmes 3.
Guy Ritchie being rewarded.
We get The Return of Jafar, directed by Guy Ritchie.
Yeah, do they start sequelizing all these?
They have to. I don't know what else they're going to do because they can't do original ideas.
Right. Right.
The thing that I'm fascinated by is I've kind of gotten past the point of the blaming Hollywood thing. I blame moviegoers because that's the only thing that they'll pay to see.
Yeah. Why is this
the thing? It's their fault. It's not. It's us.
Why is this the thing you'll leave the house and pay money for?
But aren't we also not being given choices?
True. But people are. We're being given, I think, enough choices.
Okay.
Especially in months like August, there's original stuff.
Sure.
But people are seeing Hobbs and Shaw and The Lion King still.
Right. Right. Right.
And or basically, it's not important like if a movie's good. It's just, is it going to give me what I expect it will give
right.
me? That's all that matters.
And Hobbs and Shaw replaced Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
As your favorite movie of the year?
No. In the IMAX theater after 1 week, the theater we frequent gave Once Upon a Time in Hollywood 1 week in the IMAX theater.
I saw it.
Come on.
Yeah.
Is that where you saw it in IMAX?
The second time.
Oh, okay.
I did manage to see it a second time, and I saw it in the IMAX.
One thing I think we will all agree on, it's infinitely repeatable.
Yes.
Yeah.
That it's this place where you like to go hang out.
Right.
It's fun, and there's so much happening in each scene where each time you see it, you can bring something new to it. And it's just nice to see, and I mean, like, maybe I'm being a schmuck for saying this, but it's nice to see, like, a real movie.
Right.
Yeah. It's just such a breath of fresh air. And it's also, there's kind of like a bit of a poignancy to it in the sense that we're not going to keep getting Quentin Tarantino movies forever. So I don't know. It's weird because it's a movie that I loved so much, but it also makes me mad at every other movie for not coming close to it. And it makes me want to go backwards and not go forwards in terms of watching stuff.
Right.
Like but it feels like the, oh, I'm sorry. It feels like, it just feels like the end of an era, and it's like, oh, okay, after Tarantino's done making movies and Scorsese's done making movies, maybe I could be done watching new movies.
I already feel done watching new movies.
Yeah.
That it seemed to me, and I'm a big Quentin Tarantino fan, that Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was really different than a lot of his other movies.
Yeah.
That there's something going on there. I don't want to quantify it or anything.
There's things that I'm still wrestling with, but I know that I want to keep watching it.
Just to show you how clever the film is and how, like all great films, it sort of folds back on itself. This is not original to me. God knows I never would have figured this out. This is courtesy of my much more intelligent wife. Rick's house. The front door is green. The hullabaloo clip.
Behind the green door. Yeah.
That can't be an accident.
No.
That's clever.
Yeah.
I also love how Al Pacino's character, like perhaps Tarantino, is obsessed with telling Rick how he saw the films, that these two were on 35, and then he watched two episodes of the TV show on 16mm, and then they slipped in a kinescope. It's like this.
One of my favorite things about when a Tarantino movie comes out is just like the onslaught of interviews that he does. And there's two that I really want to recommend. He's now at the point where he's doing interviews about the soundtracks and how he put together the soundtracks. So there's this site called or a podcast called Soundtracking, or I think it's Soundtracking. And like he goes through like how, you know, they got clearances for songs and how he decided on songs and then decided not to use certain songs. And it just, that's to your point, like the green door, it's like these little levels of detail. They're just so nice that people are putting the thought in their movies to make these things. So
what's the other interview?
The other one is on Spotify. It's just about his soundtrack. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought perhaps, because I always thought it was odd that in Pulp Fiction, he didn't get the Neil Diamond version of Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon.
Yeah.
I think it's Urge Overkill.
Yeah.
I may be wrong.
Yeah, it's a cover.
And that Neil Diamond proceeded to kick himself for that decision. And so a brother loves traveling salvation show,
yep.
which everyone on earth wrongfully calls Hot August Night. You know, it's the Hot August Night song. Because he put out this famous live album from the Greek Theater that was called Hot August
Got
Night.
It.
So did you see Hobbs and Shaw?
No.
I didn't either.
Hobbs and Shaw.
I really wanted to.
Is that song in Hobbs and Shaw too?
No, but Hobbs and Shaw
is... Parenthetical theme from Hobbs and Shaw. Love theme. Love theme from Hobbs and Shaw.
So with all respect to my brother at arms at Reserve Seating, Rob DiCristino, Hobbs and Shaw was like the torture scene in Siriano, but me. Like, Hobbs and Shaw was like Brando presents Hobbs and Shaw.
I saw the trailer hundreds of times, and it was the trailer where they're in this thing, and they both have to go through this thing, and The Rock...
You just described every movie this summer. Yeah.
The Rock has an easy time of it.
This was the shot list every day.
And the joke is that Jason Statham has a much more difficult job, so his room is full of people who want to kill him, and he dispatches them.
This
and
was takes... right before the moment where they take out their dicks and measure them.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And... it just looks so awful and mean-spirited. And then there's a shot where The Rock is holding a chain, and like on one side of the chain, there's something on the road that's a truck, and then there's a helicopter. Jan, my lovely wife, summarized it. She, at one point, I think it was the thing that she wrote for the summer movies, she said, at one point, The Rock throws an island at someone.
I could go on and on about Hobbs and Shaw, but the thing that I want to make a point about is the difference between the, say, Fast and Furious to Furious 7, and then Fate of the Furious and Hobbs and Shaw, is I feel like the sincerity is gone.
Okay.
Like, there used to be, yes, it was over the top, and it was silly, but it was always sincere.
I agree with you about that.
And now it's just, like, not. And then they try to make it sort of sincere, where they're just like, oh, well, we're going back to The Rock's, you know, home, and it's about family again, and it's, like, so shoehorned in. That's the thing that bugs me about it the most is just this cynicism. And, like, they're, like, it's, like, writ large with, like, The Rock and then, like, spoiler, skip ahead for 30 seconds. But, I mean, like, Ryan Reynolds shows up and Kevin Hart shows up. And it's just, like, if you would have given me this information before the movie started, I wouldn't have seen the movie. Like, you can't just spring Kevin Hart on me. You have to prepare this. You can't do that to people. He's such a fucking schmuck. I don't like him. I don't want to see his face.
At one point, does The Rock throw Kevin Hart at someone?
No, but I wanted to throw every fucking digital copy of this into the sun.
He's a comedic projectile. I'm assuming that neither of you saw it. I was such a fan. I saw it in a movie theater, and then it's already on demand if you want to watch it. And it was released in 2018 in England, but it didn't come out in the United States until 2019. So is it a 2018 release?
Tell us what it is.
If it was released here in 2019, then it's a 2019 release.
It's called All Is True. It's a Kenneth Branagh film. Mm. And he plays Shakespeare after Shakespeare retires and moves back home.
So it's like Ben Kingsley in that too.
So it's like that Roland Emmerich movie.
No, it's nothing like that Roland Emmerich movie, because that's another case where I wrote a very long comment, a column about how shitty shit, poop, poop.
Anonymous. I couldn't think of the name of that movie.
And then promptly forgot I wrote the column, and then promptly forgot that I saw the movie.
Yeah.
That movie's as bad as the day is long. But All Is True is very, very good. I recommend it very, very highly, because it's very humble. It's not trying to rewrite anything. My wife said you could easily imagine it as a stage play. It was obviously made on a really low budget. The makeup is incredible, what they do to Branagh to actually make him look like what we expect. Judi Dench plays
of course she does.
His wife. As it turns out, Shakespeare...
Dench got to eat.
Shakespeare moves back home, and... no one particularly wants him back at Stratford-upon-Avon. They wish he would have just stayed in London. His wife is not a fan. His two daughters are certainly no fan. And there's people in the town who still don't treat him well, because even though he's the genius of that century and wrote plays that'll never be equaled, his father was in disrepute, and in England they're very class conscious. And oh, you're the son of that Glover who robbed everyone. There was some money malfeasance. Ian McKellen is also in it.
Yep. This all checks out.
Earl of Southampton. But here's the deal: even though sometimes it slides into soap opera with some of the things they imagine were going on, I haven't seen a movie yet since I retired that better captures that, that more intelligently talks about you're done. Now you're done. And what do you do? And it's beautifully shot and it's wonderfully acted and it's really, really good. It's a small treasure, and I hope all of our listeners will seek it out. It's on demand right now.
Cool.
It's really good.
It was completely off my radar.
Yeah, I didn't even know about that.
It's the kind of movie that I would have seen the poster for and said to myself, oh, I'm never seeing that.
I saw the poster at South Barrington, and then a couple weeks later, it showed up at Streets of Woodfield for 1 week, contractually obligated, and then it left.
I got to say, I have noticed that I've been missing certain independent movies because I'm so in the A-list that if it doesn't play at an AMC, then I don't even know that it's out. So, like, I looked at the Regal listings. There's one by my work where they play a lot of independent movies,
yeah,
and I'm just like, the last Black Man in San Francisco or Pavarotti, and I'm just like, these aren't at AMC, so I didn't even know these existed.
Black Man in San Francisco played at a couple theaters. I think it was at the Glen Art for a week. Mm-hmm. It was in Evanston for a week.
Yeah.
Along with this new documentary about David Crosby. That's supposed to be great, but like you're saying,
there's a documentary I really wanted to see called Echo in the Canyon, and I didn't know about that until like well after it was nearby.
Echo in the Canyon opened at the Music Box, and opening night they had a band that's in the movie that's fronted by Jacob Dylan actually perform in the theater. And
hopefully theater too.
The website featured some footage of the audience enjoying this band playing, and friend of the site, Paul Stone, who goes to the Music Box even more than I do and insists on sitting in the front row, he's featured prominently in the video. And on two of the three 90th anniversary videos, he's interviewed.
Of course he is.
So it's like, that tall guy's here all the time. Find out what he has to say. But you're talking about release patterns. AMC has now introduced this.
Oh, the Artisan.
AMC Artisan. Mm-hmm. So these films were baked like bread in small batches just for you.
I'll have Ed Astra and a broccoli cheddar, please.
I'll have All Is True and the All Is True IPA.
I would like to add arugula to my Where Did You Go, Bernadette?
Check out All Is True, and the last time I checked on VOD on cable systems, Last Black Man in America, which is supposed to be really, really good, it was only available for sale, and then eventually they'll let you rent it, but it's supposed to be great.
Cool. What's another one that you liked?
From what?
From this summer.
Well, I'll tell you.
I didn't have a segue.
I didn't catch this in a theater. Just going along with what you said, some of these things are very hard to catch. It's not the greatest movie on earth, but we really gave it credit for trying. It's called Plus One.
Remind me what Plus One is.
And I'm going to have a hard time here because I don't remember.
It sounds like a Shelley Long movie from 1988.
I've seen a movie called Plus One, but it's not this movie.
Okay, a man and a woman who are in their 20s are faced with, they're very good friends, and all of their friends are getting married. So they're looking at a schedule for the year where they're going to have to attend 8 or 10 weddings apiece. And they make a pact that they will be each other's plus one at all the weddings that they're forced to attend of all these friends who are getting married. And wouldn't you know it, like, oh, I don't know, your average screenwriter, it turns out that they might have feelings for each other.
Get out of town.
And over the course of all these weddings, perhaps the two of them fall in love.
Do you remember who's in it?
Jack Quaid and Maya Erskine.
And Maya Erskine is the star of the film. She's okay. so good.
I'm not familiar with either one of them.
And I believe...
I've seen Jack Quaid in a couple things.
Is he Dennis's son?
He is.
Okay.
Right. He was in Logan Lucky. Did you see that?
I saw Logan Lucky.
He was one of like the like kind of dirty... like.
Oh, I've seen Maya Erskine in some stuff.
And it's better than it has any right to be. I'm not claiming it's a masterpiece, but it's... a nice little romantic comedy that flew under the radar. There's a lot of crap on VOD where, well, it's Wednesday night and there's nothing on, so do we want to roll the dice and spend $6 on this? Really exceeded our expectations.
Okay, that's
good. And it's very funny and very true to life. I don't want to spoil anything, but it's really, really good. So that one sort of flew under the radar until it shows up as AMC Artisanal Mead. Did either of you see Late Night?
No.
Ultimately disposable. It's you just considering who's in it and what it's about. You want it to be so much better than it is, but basically it's the trailer.
That movie, if Touchstone Pictures made it and it came out in like 1992, it would have made like $70 million.
Or 30 and still been profitable.
Yeah.
Pleasant when you're watching it. Completely predictable. When are people going to start writing movies for Emma Thompson? Although this last Christmas thing that's coming out,
which she wrote.
Oh,
she did?
Yeah.
I thought it was Paul Feig.
He directed it.
Oh, okay.
And I'm sorry, but every time I see the trailer, she's got the one laugh line in the trailer. So I'm feeling, okay, we've been through this before, but I'm hoping that her character is in the movie a lot more than the trailer suggests. She's the mom.
I'm excited about that movie because it gives me one half of my Christmas movie scorecard. It's that v. Noel with Anna Kendrick and Bill Hader that's going to be on Disney Plus. So it's all worked out.
It was not on my radar at all.
Yeah, it was one of those like Disney Plus trailers that came out with Lady and the Tramp and the Mandalorian and stuff on Friday out of D23.
Wow.
They look like real movies.
What is the story with Mandalorian? Jake sent me a text about that.
It's a weekly show, but it looks like they threw about $100 million into it.
And
it's about bounty hunters.
Is Herzog?
Yeah, he's in it.
He's a character, right?
He's in it.
Yeah.
Pablo Pascal.
I thought Disney had hired him to direct something.
Oh, that would be cool.
Which, here's an idea.
That I would say.
Like Orson Welles in Touch of Evil. Hire him to be in it and then let him direct an episode. And he would.
Ray Portakal Jakku.
I just want to hear Herzog. I can't do a Herzog, but I just want to hear him do the opening crawl a long time ago in a galaxy.
Again.
In a galaxy far, far away.
I knew you could do it.
We've been talking about the Music Box a lot because they just celebrated their 90th.
It was mist in the rain.
Their 90th anniversary.
I hear Herzog say midichlorians.
He's featured in one of the Music Box's
midichlorians
90th anniversary videos talking about the popcorn. And how much he likes it. And again, I don't do it.
Oh, it's great. Yeah.
Oh, it's like.
He's just like, I want popcorn with butter layered 3/4 down. I want to hear it run through my fingers. Not feel it. Hear it run through my fingers. And then I'll wipe it on the seat. And that's. And there is where it will live. Like a microorganism. We're jumping all around, I know.
Yeah.
But my feeling was like...
We're actually back on track for going frontal.
Okay, because my feeling was like after May, things fell off a cliff. Yeah. And I didn't see a ton of movies in June.
I disagree with you completely.
So what came out in June? Because I'm remembering stuff wrong.
Dark Phoenix.
Didn't see it. First X-Men Phoenix? I didn't see in a theater.
I saw Dark Phoenix, and I will say that it was like, the way I liken it is, you remember in Death Proof, where Kurt Russell says there's nothing more fetching than like a bruised ego on a beautiful angel.
Yeah.
That's Dark Phoenix, just like, this seems okay, but it's only because people shit on it nonstop.
Got it.
But you're not missing anything.
Wait, are you saying things went south just for June, or things went south for the rest of the summer?
Just for June.
Okay, then what I said previously is not true.
Okay.
You're completely right about June. Because
good stuff came up after June.
June goes off the cliff, including Men in Black International.
Another one. I skipped a lot of movies in June.
That was the third of my atrocious ones.
I meant to ask what...
Lion King and Hobbs and Shaw and Men in Black International.
And I have so much affection for Tessa Thompson that got me through the first 20 minutes. I'm like, okay, I'm on... No. It just quickly turns into the biggest shit show.
Is that F. Gary
Gray? Yeah.
Okay. Everything,
they don't have a story, and it's 2 hours.
It's just, it's bits and pieces of stuff that people liked from the original, and it's so, so bloody awful. And the CGI in the last 20 minutes.
I don't remember. What was the last 20 minutes?
Did the release get moved up?
Oh, I remember now.
The top of that tower and all that stuff, and there's a hole in the rift of the time. There's, we've opened a hole in something so that we can have swirling clouds and things getting sucked up. And it looks like a precocious high school student did it on his laptop. That's how bad the special effects.
It seems like a time capsule movie.
At the end of Men in Black International are.
Yeah, it was really rough. I saw that at the neighborhood theater by me, and on my walk from my apartment to the theater, it rained, so at least I was wet the whole time. So it was worth it.
So Patrick is right. I stand corrected. June goes into the sewer. June goes into the toilet. But then we're quickly... things quickly get a lot better because July begins and we get the 1-2 punch of Spider-Man Far From Home, which I thought was good, and Midsommar, which I will continue to mispronounce because I don't think it should be pronounced like any word that's in English. And so far, that's one of my favorite movies of the year.
Yeah, mine too.
It's just
same here.
So extraordinary. And I love...
That's the other movie that you saw.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Midsommar are the two... My two favorite movies of the year, for sure.
Yep.
I love...
Same.
Save it for the end of year show.
No, wait. Say that again.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Midsommar are my 1 and 2 easily for the rest of the year. I don't even want to have like a 3 through 10. If the year ended today, I would just repeat those 5 times.
And I love Midsommar so much and think it's such a masterpiece. The criticisms of it that I read on social media... Actually, this doesn't often happen. Roll off my back, and I'm very entertained by them, including, and I wish I could get this word for word, because it's the single funniest tweet I've read all year. We're back to the tweet. You were right.
Yeah, it's okay.
Someone on Twitter recounted a conversation they had with their boyfriend when the film ended, and the boyfriend turned to her and said, well, I think that guy, that... He got a lot more than he deserved, to which she responded, that's a laugh coming from you. So that's a relationship that needs to end. It's so great. Yeah. It's so deliberate. It's so – I hate to use this because people are always using this for giallo and stuff. It's so dreamlike in that a half an hour in, you see where we're going, and there's nothing you can do to stop it. And the joke I kept making with people who had seen it was that Midsommar teaches you not to be polite. Come with me.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we going?
Yeah.
No, I'm fine here.
Yeah. Right.
That was like in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the Fincher one.
Yeah.
Where Stellan Skarsgård is like, you knew what would happen if you came in here, but you just didn't want to be impolite. It's just like, yeah.
Midsommar teaches you to ask questions.
I've thought of that movie since I saw it.
You're what?
Midsommar teaches you not to be polite, to ask questions, to not just be. There's no reason to be polite.
When you're talking about, when you were talking about like the criticisms kind of rolling off your back, the thing that I think is being discounted when it comes to just using Midsommar as an example is that people are like focusing way too much on everything that's not the filmmaking, like the story and characters and stuff, but like the actual direction and like the things that he's doing with kind of the trickery with cameras and morphing and like things just tone and mood. It's like he's got, not getting any credit for it. It's like all people can focus on is like, it's too mean. Or
you know what,
like,
you know what that reminds me of? For years and years and years and years and years, I taught Romeo and Juliet to freshmen, and they always had this mania for suggesting what could have happened so that it wouldn't have ended badly. Why didn't this happen? Why didn't they do this? Why didn't he say this? Why didn't he? And I always took that as a sign that the play really works because you care so much about these characters, you don't want it to end poorly. And all of the criticisms of Midsommar are how inexorable it is and how you can't stop it and how people mm-hmm. are like, it obviously got to them and it got under their skin and it touched them, because a lot of the criticisms revolve around, well, that's not realistic. In fact, the biggest criticism is, after the first horrific thing, why didn't they all just leave? And the film answers that. The two peripheral characters try to leave, and that one guy is there because he's working on his goddamn thesis, so he has that I have an academic distance here. I'm just observing, et cetera, et cetera. The film answers these criticisms. It's so great.
It's great, like, how banal it is, too, in certain ways. The thing that I liked about it a lot was something just objectively horrifying just happens. But then somebody comes in, they're just like, it's really not as bad as you think it is, and here's context to why and everything like that. And it's like they're trying to gaslight you, or they're specifically trying to gaslight you. And I find that, and the creepiest thing about it is they believe that. It's not like they're doing it with an agenda. It's what they believe.
Right. Yeah. But there's another layer of the film that I think people, if they were to think about it, would find it even more disturbing, that for some people in the film, they're better off in this religion. They are being treated. The Pelle says, I was at wit's end. I was an orphan, and they took me in, and they made me feel better. And certainly for the lead character, she's being treated appreciably better by them than she ever has before.
I want to see a sequel to Midsommar directed by Rob Zombie, because they could open it like The Devil's Rejects.
My wife wrote a long piece about it for the website, which I recommend that everyone read, and she brought up all this mind-bending stuff. But my favorite point she brought up was, we learn that this ritual is only performed every 80 or 90 years, and then we learn that the elders are encouraged to die at around 72. So my wife cleverly did the math and said, no one there has ever participated in this ritual before. So how do we know it's ever been played out?
Yeah.
It could just be, and certainly what the film thinks about religion is more than explicit. Well, he finger paints, and we interpret the finger paintings, which is pretty much my feeling about all religions. It's a masterpiece.
It's interesting what a different, the two movies that we're talking about that we loved, and I am not saying people can't have problems with movies or if they didn't like either of those two movies, but the little bit of reaction that I saw, because I do try to stay out of so much of it, it seemed that both movies were very polarizing, both Midsommar and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yes.
And it just, they're held to a completely different standard than anything else that came out this summer.
Yeah, I agree with that, because people don't have these debates picking apart Men in Black International because they forget about Men in Black International.
Right. While we're on this topic, there is one thing I wanted to bring up, and this speaks directly to what you're saying. The biggest critique of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood I heard this summer was, A, that somehow the film doesn't like women, which I don't see at all for a number of reasons.
I don't either. Yeah.
And B, that it was racist and it was unkind to the memory of Bruce Lee, which I also don't think was true for a number of reasons. But I was looking at the Rotten Tomatoes scores for certain films, which I never do. And I think this gets to the heart of what the two of you are saying. For Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the critic score was in the 70s or 80s, and the audience score was in the 70s. And then I looked up Blinded by the Light, which we'll get to, and the critic score was in the 90s, and the audience score was 98.
Yep.
Now, clearly, this is not the same audience weighing in on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Blinded by the Light. The Once Upon a Time in Hollywood audience are hipster douchebags who are going to frequent social media and pick everything apart in terms of political correctness. And the people weighing in on Blinded by the Light are, oh, it was cute and fun, and I like Bruce Springsteen.
Right.
So there's a completely different critical mentality being used for the two films.
Yeah, the Rotten Tomatoes thing is weird for me because it's just what percentage of 100 people give this movie a recommendation. It doesn't mean, like, you know, if it's 90%, it's 4 stars, or if it's 80%, it's 3.5 stars. There's no nuance to it. There's other indexes for that. But the thing is, like, you look at Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and it's like, oh, it's at 85 or so. But then you see, like, Angry Birds 2 is at, like, 78. And it's just like, well, okay, no, nothing means anything anymore. That's one thing that I feel kind of just sort of without a rudder on with this whole thing with movies now is, like, you can't trust reviews. You can't trust, like, Oscars. You can't really trust what makes money. So it's just like we're all just kind of out on our own,
yeah.
Which in a way is nice, but in a way, too, is sort of like, why are we arguing so much about it? Because there's no barometer for any of this anymore.
There's so much to guide us now, whether it's Twitter or Rotten Tomatoes or Metacritic or whatever. There's so many different ways to help us form an opinion that it all becomes meaningless.
Mm-hmm. Which I was going to say, this is Hollywood's wet dream. There used to be critics who agree or disagree, knew something about film and reviewed all the major films. And you could find a couple who you liked or enjoyed reading or agreed with, and you could be guided by them. But now there's 7,000 voices.
Yep.
And like you said, you're on your own, which I think Hollywood would love.
Sure.
Oh,
that's how Lion King makes $1 billion.
There's no longer 5 men who can make or break a movie and whose review might actually determine how many screens it ends up on.
Yeah.
Spider-Man Far From Home was a movie that I enjoyed while it was on and haven't really thought about since.
Exactly.
I liked it when it was the most, like, when it was kind of feeding more into, like, the Sam Raimi bits than the MCU bits.
Yeah, that was... But that's interesting.
Yeah, but I liked it. But then again, like, when I guess it's an indicator of kind of how sticky that movie is when I hear the news about, like, oh, you know, no more Spider-Man in the MCU. I'm just kind of like, all right, sure. Like, would I have seen it if they made another one? Yeah. Right. If they don't make another one, am I going to be upset? No, not really.
I really like Tom Holland as Spider-Man. I really like him in those movies. I like him in the Marvel movies. I think he has a different energy than everybody else, and he's always a bright spot. So it's a bummer, but I also, like, can't control what multi-conglomerate corporations do, so I guess I'm powerless. Like, all right, so no more Spider-Man.
Yeah.
I'll just have to watch the 7 movies he's in or whatever, like, just of the MCU, you know.
Yeah,
I thought this one worked really good as
like
a lot of people thought, like, Homecoming worked really well as, like, a teen comedy. I felt that more with this one. Like, I just laughed more. I thought the stuff with his friend Ned with the girl that he was, like,
that was all my favorite stuff in the movie.
I thought that was great.
Mysterio stuff was not as interesting to me. I liked all the human stuff.
I like Gyllenhaal. I thought he was kind of doing, like, a PG-13 Nightcrawler thing, so that was fun. But
there's just been so many movies where the villain's motivation is the same.
Stark.
Yeah. It's like, how many disgruntled Stark employees are we going to get?
More.
Yeah.
That's how many.
And then on...
one of them works for Sony. That'd be hilarious if in the next Marvel movie, it's just like, I used to work for Sony.
Yeah.
I'm mad.
And then on July 15th, there was this terrific screening of Back to the Future.
Yeah, there was.
At the Elk Grove Cinema that featured a live podcast value added.
It was fun. That's a good movie.
And
thank you again to all of you who came in from out of town.
And this was the event of the year because we had people driving in from Toronto and giving us the lowdown on poutine.
Did we talk about the sequels at all on the podcast recently?
you did. You said that you your recent watch is that you don't want them in your head. Right. Yeah.
Then never mind.
Yeah. Because part two,
they've been shown on cable a lot, and I don't want the sequels in my head.
Part two is the next critics' classics.
Yes.
And in just a couple weeks, the Music Box is showing part two in 70 millimeter.
Mm-hmm.
So part two is everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't remember a movie that I didn't see the Friday it opened that more people did not solicit my opinion. Everyone wanted to know what I thought of Yesterday because I'm the biggest Beatles fan I know by weight, if not by enthusiasm. And I finally went to see Yesterday, and as much as I liked hearing the songs in a different way, you know, the main character sings and plays guitar, and it's always nice to hear Beatles songs, I thought it was pretty awful. And someone smarter than me said, the problem with Yesterday is the minute you begin to think about it at all, the whole thing just falls apart. It doesn't make much sense. But much like that famous screening of Hugo that you attended that just left me destroyed because, like Brian Wilson watching E.T., when Brian Wilson went to see E.T., he secretly thought Steven Spielberg had made the film about him as a metaphor for him. And I was sitting there thinking, Martin Scorsese made this film for me and no other person. Have either of you seen Yesterday?
Yes, I saw it at the critics' film screening at the Music Box, and that
and you
was,
and Mark were really polite about not wanting to pollute my mind with your opinion,
right? Because I mean, I had that recently. I was talking to my dad about Blinded by the Light, and he really loved it. And we're both he passed Springsteen down to me, so we're both big Springsteen fans, and he loved it, and I didn't. And then he was like, "Well, what did you think of it?" I'm like, "I don't really want to talk about it." And then he's just, and I was protecting like his. Mm-hmm. Appreciation for it.
Okay. The thing, first of all, you're right about Blinded by the Light.
So the thing with Yesterday, I didn't see it in a good circumstance because it was so heightened. It was like watching it with a live studio audience.
That's true of a lot of the
of Music Box screenings. It's weird. I don't know. I don't like it. I want to see something kind of in a more neutral setting. But the thing that fucking pissed me off about Yesterday was like it was so uncurious to go down any rabbit hole of its own premise, which is fascinating. And I don't know what it's trying to say about the Beatles, really, because ostensibly they're saying, like, oh, the Beatles are amazing and the world is a better place with the Beatles in it. But it's also saying, like, I love the Beatles so much that I want to steal the Beatles.
Yes.
And it won't deal with that.
Not in any way.
Yeah.
Early in the film, for those of you who haven't seen it, and you shouldn't, there's this cataclysmic event, and the Beatles never existed. So this one guy, because he got into a bicycle accident and he passed out or something, missed the cosmic mindfuck of the century, and he still remembers the Beatles. And luckily, he's a performer, so he begins to perform the Beatles songs, and he becomes famous doing them. Early on at some of his concerts, there are some people in the background who seem to be strangely drawn to him. And there's this one Russian guy, and then later there's an English woman.
They're the Adjustment Bureau.
And it's very fascinating when they're on the periphery. And I'm like, this film really would have been better if they had just left that unexplained. Like, what is it with those people who keep needing to come to his concerts? But then, of course, the film makes it insultingly specific what's going on, and it stops being interesting.
Could you imagine that premise if it was 30 minutes and Rod Serling had his hands on it?
I think Yesterday would be improved as a Twilight Zone.
Yeah,
episode.
For sure. Yeah.
But I will say that, like Hugo, there's a scene in the film, massive spoilers follow, where one of these peripheral characters has tracked someone down and gives the protagonist an address, and he goes to visit John Lennon. And again, in terms of the film's bizarre premise, Lennon still lived, but he did not get to be in a band that became famous. And it certainly suggested that because he didn't become famous, he wasn't assassinated, which I find very fascinating as a metaphysical concept. And so the protagonist spends an afternoon with Lennon, and they just talk. And it just destroyed me.
Yeah.
Because we're seeing an 80-year-old John Lennon. And John Lennon didn't get to be 80. John Lennon was assassinated when he was 40. So I think, almost like what you said, had it explored that.
Yeah.
But it's not interested in exploring that.
It's just exploring the romance between Himesh Patel and Lily James. And
yes.
As much as individually, I think they're very charming and charismatic, I just don't think like their relationship is all that compelling.
And I don't think any...
To focus on just that...
Any part of that
weird.
Works.
No.
And as someone who I was talking to someone at Beetlefest about yesterday, and I said I hated the film, but that one scene really got to me.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, but think about that scene. What? There's nothing to it. That there's your desire for John Lennon to have lived, and you're getting this glimpse of him at 80 or something. But nothing in their conversation. There's one cheap joke where he says, I think you should seek mental health.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I do not recommend Yesterday.
Yeah. So Blinded by the Light.
Although I will say this before we get to Blinded by the Light. Yesterday is manifestly better than Supervised, which I actually got to see in a theater.
Was that the Tom Berenger one?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, as bad as the day is long. Blinded by the Light.
Yeah.
I was trepidatious about going in because watching the trailer 85 times, my God, they showed that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't be the only one who thought, this is Bend It Like Beckham with Springsteen instead of soccer.
Well, you know.
And it's even directed by the same woman.
Yeah, yeah.
Whose film company is now called like Bend It Like Film. So I'm glad that film was a success. But it's so bad.
Yeah.
It's just so bad. And I love Springsteen a lot. I've seen Springsteen live probably more than any other band I've seen live. I've seen Springsteen a lot. I have all of his records. But
there's E Street Radio on Sirius XM. And I'm a big Springsteen fan, but when I hear the people on E Street Radio, I'm like, these people are creepy. Like, they're empty vessels just only filled by Bruce Springsteen. And that's what this guy was, like, at least as portrayed in the movie. I know it's based on his book or whatever, but, like, the lead actor or the lead performer, character, whatever, he's like a big Springsteen bully. And, like, it's weird. And the thing that was driving me up the wall about this movie was it's only focusing on Springsteen's special because he was from New Jersey, working class, and here are the lyrics. They don't take into account anything else about music other than just the words. And a lot, I listen to music for like, okay, I'm not one of the people who respond to lyrics as much. I respond to the music because a certain way, like a chord will hit or like strings or whatever, like it can stir you like emotionally. And there's not even a passing mention about Patti Scialfa or Clarence Clemons or Max Weinberg or anything like that. Nothing. It's like he doesn't even know that they exist.
It's not seen as music. It's
yeah.
It could just as well be a book
right.
of the lyrics. Because as the film makes clear,
yeah.
and you've seen it in the trailer, there's all these scenes where the words appear everywhere
yeah.
on the screen.
Yeah. I have an alternate title for Blinded by the Light. # My Springsteen. Because that's what that movie was.
And every other part of it other than the Springsteen angle is really note for note Bend It Like Beckham down
yeah.
to the girl's parents who are objects of ridicule and scorn because of their lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just...
It's the same scene over and over again.
One to one to one.
Yeah.
My wife said that she got really tired of the protagonist doing nothing but making puppy eyes at everyone.
Yeah.
He has this one look that he gives everyone because he's so put upon.
Hmm. Yeah. And he's automatically this great writer. It's like there's never any type of criticism of any of his poetry or stuff he writes. It's just like you're brilliant.
And he's so passive that it's almost amazing. Yeah. Well, I submitted that essay, and you won this big contest, and you had to do nothing.
Yeah.
You just sit there and make puppy eyes, and everyone around you will...
And he gets a girlfriend because Springsteen had love songs, and he needs to project them at someone. It's like there's no relationship there. He's just like, I have to have a hungry heart about something.
And Rob Brydon.
And it's the popcorn at the music box.
Rob Brydon is in it, in this tiny, thankless role that just makes you wish that the next
trip movie
would come out.
Yeah.
So I got to see both these movies is my takeaway.
They're so good.
I
like music.
I can save you four. I could save you four hours of your life.
Yeah.
In the car.
Yeah.
20 minutes of the Beatles.
Okay.
20 minutes of Springsteen. Mm-hmm.
Who's got that kind of time?
You're done.
All right.
You do in the car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'm saving you 4 hours in a
theater. Oh, good point.
And up to, well, I
that
don't know.
Leaves me so much time to watch Yesterday and Blinded by the Light.
No, you're missing the point.
Fuck.
That's what we're trying to avoid. Here, let me. I'll draw a diagram.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. We're missing some big ones.
Yeah, let's hear them.
Toy Story 4.
I saw that.
I did too.
Well, I don't know.
I liked
what to
it
say
when
it
was called Toy Story 2 and 3.
Me too.
Yeah.
Patrick and I saw it under the strangest of conditions.
Oh, yeah, we did at a child's birthday party.
A friend of ours
Ooh.
Had a dual birthday party for two of her sons and rented out the whole theater.
Yeah.
And that was the party. And that whole thing, I was like, oh.
It's very cute.
I do this more.
Yeah.
I like it a lot. But
Toy Story 4 was weird because for like an hour, I wasn't into it at all. It's not that I didn't like it. It was just like, whatever. And then like the end was kind of interesting and sort of weepy. And then I walked out of the theater. I'm like, oh, that was good. And then like, I'm just like, no, it tricked me. It was like that last act and that was it.
See, I didn't feel emotional in the last act at all because all I could think of was you guys have done this beat
for
two movies already.
Yeah.
Toy Story 4 made me wish, and I've talked about this before, the scene in 3 where they're all holding hands and they're going to go into the fire and Pixar strings it out so long you think, are they really going to do it? Toy Story 4 made me wish they had. Into the fire. The end. It's a toy.
Yeah.
Although at the end of Toy Story 3, when he decides to give the toys to another kid, I thought that was sweet because that's what you should do. But
it kind of ends the story.
Toy Story 4 is so disposable, and I sat there through the entire thing wondering what machinations were behind Hanks really being the lead and Buzz really taking a back seat.
Yeah.
And it made me wonder, Tim Allen is sort of famous for not being easy to work with, and I wondered if that had anything to do with it, that Tom Hanks is a famously nice guy, and you, sir, might be a pain in the ass, so we're going to relegate your character to supporting, but does that mean that Toy Story 5 will have Buzz in the lead? Maybe that was part of the contract, because clearly they can now make Toy Story 5, and Buzz might not be in it.
Woody.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert for Toy Story 4.
Yeah.
I want them to just, like, introduce some kind of, like, earth-shaking element to this, where they have the toys, and they'd be like, goodbye, buddy, and it's just like, but what will he do for work? And then it's just like, wait a minute.
I'm still traumatized.
When will he eat?
I'm still traumatized because the bad guy in Toy Story 2 looks exactly like me. And for a year after that film came out, I got that from people, which I did not like.
Toy Story 2 is still the peak, I think.
I like the first one the most.
So. I love the first one. Yeah. The second one, I thought the story was very clever, and I will maintain that 90-second Sarah McLachlan montage, When She Loved Me, is all they've been doing now for two movies. They just keep expanding that idea to feature length, but it was this beautiful, perfect little 90-second thing.
And both the original Toy Story and Toy Story 2 had something to say and had done some thinking about toys and our relationship to toys. And that was good, and I think that's one of the reasons why people responded. My favorite thing in Toy Story 2 is that Stinky Pete is mint in box, and he's an asshole because he's never been played with.
Mm-hmm. That toys.
But they keep doing that character then.
Right.
I'm the grouchy toy because I was left cast aside. I was whatever. Toy Story 4 was fine. Like, it's reasonably well written. I like the Toy Story movies. I like those characters. But it did feel like so many of the movies this summer, which is just like, I don't know, we got to make one of these.
Yeah. Here's
Men in
one.
Black. Like, yep. We got to make
Here's
one of these.
Another one. Mm-hmm.
And Toy Story 4 was very, because I sit there through Toy Story 4 thinking, boy, I would much rather Pixar start making original films. But then I see the trailer for their next original film, and I'm like, I could probably go for a Toy Story 5.
Yeah. What is the next Pixar?
There's two. There's Onward, which is
Onward
about
is the one that I saw the trailer
gnomes
for.
Gnomes or elves or whatever. Yeah. And then there's one called Soul, which I think is more about like music than it is about like Inside Out Soul.
Hmm.
From what I'm hearing. Don't. But anyways. John Wick 3?
John Wick 3 is amazing.
John Wick 3 is really good.
Yeah.
And I give them a lot of credit for, I always compare it to The Raid and The Raid 2. That The Raid 2 didn't just copy The Raid.
No.
They went in a different direction.
Yes.
And each of the John Wick films are very, very different in the way they go about being an action film, and I appreciate that.
Well, and it's going in a very specific direction, and I understand if people don't like that direction, because it's going much more into, not science fiction, but, you know, it's going further and further into the secret world
the
of assassins.
You know,
whereas the first one seems like, oh, this could take place in the real world. The second one is kind of one foot in, one foot out. This one is basically entirely within that mm-hmm. crazy world. So I understand if people are like, I'm not so much into that aspect of it. These movies might leave you a little bit cold, but I love how far they're willing to go into this nonsense to the point where he's, you know, crossing a desert.
Yeah, I mean, like, I have some of those complaints, but, like, they don't really matter because they're so outweighed by,
right.
God, Keanu Reeves is great.
Yes,
or,
he is.
Like, these action sequences, like, I really appreciate just all of the thought and kind of humor and just everything that goes into it. It's like,
they're jaw-dropping.
They're paying, it's just payoff, payoff, payoff. It's great. It's wonderful.
I've liked movies better this year and this summer, but I don't know if there's like a single sequence I've had more fun with than the whole knife fight.
I was just going
to. The antique knives.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's like building that gun just to shoot one guy. It's crazy.
Whenever a film does something really well, physically, I always say the same thing in my head. Buster Keaton would be proud.
Yeah, right.
That you've actually worked out the physics of this.
Right.
Yeah.
Way to go.
Speaking of Buster Keaton would be proud, I watched The Intruder this morning, and it's this year's.
Is this the Dennis Quaid movie?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Wait, he's Jack Quaid's dad.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Okay. I remember him.
I'm going to recommend The Intruder.
Of course you are.
Because it's this summer's wish upon, and I was waiting for it.
Oh, boy.
And I found it. And he should have won an MTV Movie Award for this performance. He single-handedly, okay, it's like
he... Does he do it like Jerry Lee Lewis?
Oh, my God.
Now I'm the intruder!
It's crazy because it's like
I love that performance.
It's like this...
I love that performance.
I love that movie.
It's this Screen Gems movie. Just Michael Ealy, generic as fuck. It's just terrible. It's just stupid. And then Dennis Quaid is just like, you're making a 90s thriller? Let me show you how to make a 90s thriller. And it's just, he sinks his teeth into it like a rabid dog. It's such a fun performance that elevates the movie into being fun and so bad it's good. So I was pleasantly surprised by that one.
All right. Did that come out this summer?
Yeah. It came out like May 3rd.
Jesus. So.
Great Balls of Fire also features John Doe. As Myra's father, playing what could be the same character that he plays in Boogie Nights. Your Honor, what she's not telling you is that my wife is involved in pornography. And then the clouds part, and it's July 28th or thereabouts, July 25th, July 28th, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is released.
Yes.
And the year is made better. Because we finally have a film that's not a remake or a sequel, that's an original thing that people are actually going to see and talking about. A film that, from what I can see, people are going to multiple times, which doesn't happen a lot anymore. And it's a film that you can just sort of go and hang out in.
And it makes me want to watch other movies, which didn't happen in any other movie this summer.
You were on a tear, like, to see every movie that the movie references, because you sent me a text about Krakatoa east of Java.
Yeah.
Which, complete F this movie honesty policy, to film fans, that title is a big joke, because if you look on any map, Krakatoa is actually west of Java. Thank you very much. But that's what's playing at the Cinerama Dome in the reality.
But you
of
talked
film.
Me out of blind buying it.
Oh, I didn't even realize I'd save you some money.
It was a Kino Lorber sale, and I was like, well, it's $7. Do I get it? And I did not.
It was a major pilgrimage when my son moved to L.A. the day he finally took me to the Cinerama Dome. I don't know if there's a better movie theater anywhere.
That's one of the L.A. theaters I haven't been to yet. I really want
to
go.
And oddly enough, I have yet to see a movie there, because the movie we were going to see, they built a multiplex next to it, like to... Which I actually think was clever because
they did
the
that at the TCL Chinese Theater. Also.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
If the multiplex helps bankroll this amazing theater, the Cinerama Dome was actually built to show It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, and every couple of years TCM Fest shows It's a Mad, 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 Mad World in the original Cinerama Dome. I think I wrote a column about this. We walked to the dome part, and I tried to talk an usher into letting me in the auditorium. I explained, I'm a film study teacher. This place is very historic. And he said, no, you need a ticket. So we went to our movie. It was The Lobster. And then when that was over, there was a different usher in charge of the gates. And I gave him the exact same spiel. Go ahead, man. And I actually got to stand in the theater, and just seeing the way it's laid out and seeing the screen, oh, you know, any fucking movie that you would see there would just be special. And you saw this summer what they did for Godzilla.
Oh, we forgot about Godzilla.
There's a whole podcast
that
on
came
it.
Out this summer.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun. They built... I think it was.
I think I enjoyed parts of it. But
on the complete spectrum here. You liked it middle... No.
They built an enormous Godzilla head seemingly crashing through the dome.
Yeah.
And
that's pretty cool.
At night, it had a big spotlight shooting up into the sky, like the scene in the film. And because the film did not do well, I felt bad because they did all of that for a week. I think it only played there for a week because Michael Dougherty was tweeting like crazy.
Sure.
Look what the dome did. Look what the dome did.
Related to Godzilla and giant monsters, when I talked to Jeff Goldblum, I had time for one question, so I asked him, when you're working with a practical effects dinosaur, is it scary or do they seem like inanimate objects? And he was just like, oh, no, they're very scary. They seem very real. And it was like he was warning me.
Well, that's really cool.
It was really neat. But it was something I was wondering, and I wanted to ask either him or at Days of the Dead, ask Richard Dreyfuss. I'm like, what is it like with the shark? Like, what is that like?
I think Dreyfuss would appreciate that, although I'm sort of looking forward to that.
Yeah.
But I've heard that he can be obstreperous.
He does not
suffer fools gladly.
Do you watch those GQ or Vanity Fair YouTube videos where they have an actor and they go through their career for 15 minutes?
Yeah, I do.
They're great. But, Richard Dreyfuss, his What About Bob story is pretty great because he's just like, Bill Murray is an Irish drunk. But he's just very, cantankerous. And stuff,
you know, every time he shows up at one of these shows, and he's been doing a lot of shows lately, it's like, I'm sorry you didn't save more of your money from your heyday. Or maybe you enjoy treating fans poorly, so be my guest, but come on.
But he said that he doesn't suffer fools. My immediate thought was, I'm like, I think I'm a fool.
You know what it reminds me of?
I'll just pun.
The Flashback Weekend once had a Linda Blair, and they had a screening of The Exorcist, and she introduced the film. And in less than 10 minutes, alienated everyone there because this was a stage where she was not happy that this was the source of her fame. And she kept insisting that it wasn't a horror film, that it was a theological thriller.
Hmm.
And that later in the dealer's room, some fans brought this Reagan head that they had obviously spent hundreds of hours on, and she began to shriek, I'm not exaggerating, and yell, get that away from me. And I think someone had a talk with Miss Blair, because the next time she appeared at Flashback Weekend, her demeanor was very different.
Yeah.
Speaking of Richard Dreyfuss, do I need to see The Big Fix?
Yes.
It's a Twilight Time movie, and I haven't wanted to drop $30 on it, but I really want to see it.
It's that really interesting time in the 70s where people were doing, I believe it's directed by Jeremiah Chechik, and it's really good.
Okay.
But in that 70s way that
yeah,
some people
no, that,
don't
I love
like.
That. No, I love it.
It's
so.
It's really, really good.
All right. Good
and
to know.
And then a little film comes out called Crawl, which I believe
Crawl,
all three of us
right?
have
We're
seen.
Talking about Crawl?
Yeah.
No, that's much older. Did you see Crawl?
I did see Crawl.
And you did too.
Yeah.
And it was great. Was it not?
It was
it's fun.
But it was fun, but not great.
Jinx, buy you a Diet Coke from
I
Jillian
think,
Jacobs.
Thank you. Yeah. I think fun is kind of what it aspires to be, yeah. So I think it's successful in that regard.
Sure,
I don't think
it's trying to be Citizen Kane.
Yeah, I think it's a good version of what it is. Yeah.
I was surprised when it was over that it was filmed in Serbia, because
I was not surprised.
They did a good job of the one.
It didn't seem like that flooded
like
house was in Serbia.
Yeah. The one practical set of the house, the street, and the convenience store, I thought that was a pretty impressive practical set.
I kept thinking about how great the two performances were because they were wet and dirty all the time.
I was just thinking about how much it sucks to make movies sometimes. Yeah. Like, it's this glamorous, great job, but
and
then
you
watch a movie like Crawl and you're like, oh, but sometimes it's miserable.
Yeah. And you can't watch the film and not think, oh my God, day in and day out, you are
and you have to
dirty
act terrified all the time. And,
but maybe that would help.
But I appreciated the extent to which they tried to make them actual characters and give them a backstory and a relationship so that by the time the alligators show up, you're like, you actually give a shit about what's going on, because most movies like this don't do that. We'd get alligators in the first 10 minutes.
I thought it was a great example of what it was trying to be.
Yeah.
I still have a problem with the CG alligators. I can't be afraid of, to Jeff Goldblum's point, I can't be afraid of a CG alligator.
I jumped the first time the alligator showed up because I was not expecting
it.
Like, and I thought that was one of the really strong suits of the movie, was when it you're waiting and you're waiting and you're waiting, and then when it happens,
W-A-D-I-N-G.
Yeah, it's like about 70% of to the time that you think they're going to show up.
Right,
and
right.
like, oh, no, they're here already.
Right,
so,
But here's another lesson in never watching trailers, because,
they
play
that trailer a lot.
Because I've been going to movies more, I see these trailers over and over and over. And one of my favorite parts in the Crawl trailer was when she lures the gator into the shower that's flooded and then closes the door. And it's like, yes, you outsmarted the alligator. And I'm watching the film, and that scene doesn't come. So I'm like, is this in the trailer but not in the film? And then the narrative is unspooling, and it occurs to me that they've just spoiled a major plot point.
Right,
because if you have half a brain, you're like, oh, for that scene to happen, and that kind of ruined that, which I thought was bad.
Yeah.
Did either of you see The Farewell?
Yes.
No.
Did you like it?
I thought it was good and very effective. I think it was maybe hyped for me a little too much.
It was certainly hyped a lot.
Yeah, but it's good.
The reason I liked it as much as I did, and I liked it a lot, we look at all these films that we've been talking about today that are so formulaic in Hollywood, and you know exactly where it's going to go.
Yeah.
I thought The Farewell was an example of, you can sit there and you're waiting for it to go Hollywood, and it never does.
No.
In fact, I would argue the family's matriarch, the grandmother, is dying of cancer, and no one's going to tell her, because apparently there is a school of thought that says the person who's going to die doesn't need to know. And so they use this wedding as an excuse to get together and all see the grandmother one last time. And as an American, as you know, you're like, well, how can you do that? Because the film even says, in America, that's illegal. You have to inform the patient of what's going on. Mm-hmm. But I actually thought the film made a fairly convincing case that that might not be the worst thing to do.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was... it reminded me a lot of movies that I sadly have kind of gotten away from a bit. But like when I worked at Blockbuster and you get 5 new releases a week and you're a student and you've got all the time in the world. Like I would like to, I used to like going down like the foreign film aisle. And then usually the ones that were available were like the early Ang Lee movies, like The Wedding Banquet or Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. And it kind of reminded me of that. And I miss watching those movies. Those are really good. And, they have, the movie was really working for me, but I didn't cry. And then at the end credits, they basically like landed the knockout punch because this isn't spoiling anything, but the end credits, they do like a Chinese language version of, that Harry Nielsen song. Yeah. I can't live without you. And I was just like, son of a bitch.
And I kept giving it credit for not going the Hollywood direction and constantly subverting your expectations until the end credits, where you can see some studio executives saying, you have to include that.
Yeah.
And the thing I'm talking about, which I don't want to spoil, that almost ruined the movie for me.
Oh, wow.
There is no reason for that to be in the film other than, oh, I'm afraid that people are going to leave the theater melancholy and we don't want that. Because
So we're talking blooper reel?
No.
Oh, I thought it made it. Oh, I see what you're saying.
Whether or not the grandmother knows, that final scene where they all get in the cab, the grandmother's very emotional about saying goodbye.
Yeah, oh, God, that's a great scene.
And you're sitting there thinking, it doesn't matter if she knows or not.
Yeah.
Given what we've learned, this could very well be the last time she's going to see these people.
Yeah.
Earlier in the film, it's brought up. This is the first time the grandmothers had both sons in the house at the same time in 25 years.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about it, the more I like it.
It's a great film.
It's a good movie
that you all should see. And I give Awkwafina so much credit for subverting every tendency of any music personality / stand-up who's ever appeared in a film. She disappears in the film. You would never know that she had this other career.
It was another type of like Taryn Edgerton situation, because every time I've seen her, it's been in Crazy Rich Asians or Ocean's 8, where she's like the I'm from Brooklyn girl, like hipster girl.
Right.
So, yeah.
And whoever directed The Farewell, which is based on a real lie, it says at the beginning, really got her to play a real person and not do anything. I can't recommend it enough. It's a great film.
Yep.
We played the Chicago Critics Film Festival. I did not see it there. I wish I would have. I think it sold it out.
The trailer is really dishonest in that it's selling a film that The Farewell is not.
Okay.
So this whole thing about me saying I give it so much credit for not going Hollywood, the studio, through the trailer, is going to make it look like something that's less.
Are we in August already?
We are now in August because The Farewell comes out August 12th.
Or are we forgetting? We got Hobbs and Shaw.
At the end, I can go back because I had a few from pre-August
didn't
go through. Yeah, but we could double back. So, Scary Stories, that was August.
Yeah.
I didn't like it.
I didn't either.
I thought it should have been an anthology.
You did not see it, right?
I haven't seen it yet.
Making it an anthology would have solved a lot of the problems.
Yeah.
And it's trying
That's weird, because I thought it was.
You would think it would be. And I remember seeing the trailer and wondering why they went with that structure. And, I mean, it's worked, because Goosebumps was not an anthology, and I thought Goosebumps worked.
Yeah.
What are they... Well...
I think
we don't need to get into it. They're trying
going
to do so much stuff with like Vietnam and Nixon.
The only thing I can think of, and this is a weird way of like for Scary Stories to tell in the dark to be the Vietnam movie, but like the only thing I could think of was these kids basically were like on a death march, whether it's
sort
be
of inevitability,
via
right?
These folk tales, or like they're on their way to war. It's the only thing I could think of.
Yeah, I guess that's what I took away too. I just thought it was a weird choice.
Also, the way the movie's trying to dramatize it wasn't really good.
No, it was just the camera would move past a TV and be like, "Oh, and Nixon's going to be reelected."
Or, yeah,
yeah, elected, I should say.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was a weird thing to try and include into a horror movie aimed at preteens, like
2019 preteens.
But I thought all the scary stuff was disappointing. I thought the narrative didn't work. I just, it was a big disappointment for me.
Yeah. It was one of those movies where like early on, I'm like, I can't get my bearings on this. Like it just seemed kind of disjointed and there's just no consistent tone to it. And then it just did that for 2 hours.
Yeah.
It was weird.
Yeah. I mean, they brought some drawings to life, so I guess it gets credit for that.
Sure.
That got some attention when it first came out.
Yeah. Sure. Good job.
Did you guys see 47 Meters Down Uncaged?
No, I still haven't seen 47 Meters Down.
That one I like.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, 47 Meters Down Uncaged is like the worst movie of the year for the first 30 minutes.
Oh, interesting.
And then it gets there's some fun stuff in the last hour, but it's not enough to make it worth watching. Really.
Okay.
So, but there, and it's like they have some of the most wooden horror protagonists that you'll ever see in a movie. It's almost like shockingly inept, the setup of the movie. It's weird.
My favorite thing about 47 Meters Down Uncaged Again is the picture you took of your daughter Rosie by the cardboard stand-up in the lobby. That was good.
Yeah,
it's almost like those movies are made just so they have those cardboard stand-ups in the lobby.
The movie is shit, but we've got a hell of a stand-up.
They're like, what do we do with this Downton Abbey stand-up? It's like, can we put a chair in there somewhere? Then the movie is greenlit. Put the chair in there. The Art of Racing in the Rain, a.k.a. Costner Dog.
That might be the trailer I saw more than any other trailer. My God, they were showing that early.
Yeah, it's not good. It's not a good movie. It tricked me while I was watching it because I was like kind of into it. And then I was sitting there next to Rob and he was laughing. And I was just like, don't you get it? This is amazing. And then I walked out of the theater. I'm like, oh, wait, I was just totally manipulated, like in the worst possible way.
Every time I saw the trailer,
Costner dog.
Yeah.
Every time I saw the trailer, I imagined a scene in the movie where the dog says, I'm completely disinterested and I'm doing this just for the paycheck.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, like, it's just, yeah, I don't know. I don't get it. Like, the Costner voiceover narration is so weird because he's obviously trying to speak through the POV of a dog.
Right, but what you said in the column isn't true, right? That he did it into his phone one afternoon?
No, that was Rob. Okay. He was just making a joke. Okay. No, but he...
No, don't laugh. Bill Murray did one of those Garfields movies on a plane with an iPhone.
For real?
No joke.
Yeah, no.
How long's the flight? This is going to work.
Holy cow.
No, it's weird, though, because, like, even the tone of Costner's voice, it sounds like he's just like, but he's, like, speaking through that. So he's just like, racetrack, race cars.
There's that scene in the trailer when he's looking at the pregnant Amanda Seyfried and says, I hope it looks like me. And it's like, that is the dumbest fucking thing I've ever.
Because I fucked her.
Can I spoil The Art of Racing in the Rain?
I can't. Come on.
Can I spoil two things about The Art of Racing in the Rain? Or three things. So skip ahead for 3 minutes
if you don't want this movie spoiled.
Your conversation right now is the most pleasure anyone has ever gotten out of the movie.
Okay, what would you think would happen at the end of The Art of Racing in the Rain?
The dog dies.
So sure, the dog dies. What do you think happens in the middle of The Art of Racing in the Rain?
Milo Ventimiglia's dad dies.
No, Amanda Seyfried, his wife, dies of cancer.
Oh, Jesus.
What do you think happens in the third act of it? There's a custody battle for their daughter and his in-laws, her parents, because they don't think that he's can raise their daughter because he's a race car driver.
Wow.
Yeah, so that movie is just like kicking you in the nuts with manipulation.
What is that? What does any of that have to do with the dog?
The dog? Rough.
How was the experience of watching The Art of Racing in the Rain?
Rot very good.
Rot row.
Ryan, rot roaring.
Werner Herzog's dog.
Right, red, rot, roar. It was a large, rot, roar, rit, runner.
Give that dog some popcorn.
Ready or not,
the dog is trying to get a chew toy over a hill.
That took me like 7 nanoseconds to get the reference. Ready or Not, I really, really liked and would put in the same category as Crawl. It's not trying to reinvent the wheel, but it's very, very well made and very entertaining.
Ready or Not for me was a little bit of a victim of the trailer situation because I saw the trailer a bunch of times. And once you've seen the trailer a bunch of times, the movie doesn't really have any surprises. It kind of just plays out exactly the way you think it's going to play out.
Yeah.
I thought it was well done. I had enough fun with it. I think I wanted to love it more given some of the online reaction. I like Samara Weaving a lot. And I would probably liken it to Crawl.
In the
same Adam was not as big a fan.
Way as we were discussing Midsommar, and I'm going to try and phrase this so it's not a spoiler because it just opened. The film at the end suggests that it's going to go in a very different direction than the direction it actually goes in. There's a fake out. And I was sitting there in the theater thinking how much more I would have liked the film if they had gone with the fake out.
Okay.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. I felt the same way.
Yeah. That would have been kind of interesting to see how that plays out. But I thought it was very well made. I thought it was very suspenseful. I thought it was very scary. I thought all the, all the kills.
I liked her a lot. Like, Samara Weaving, I felt like had...
You have to watch Mayhem.
This real it factor to her.
Yeah.
And everybody else didn't. And I felt like... She's better than this movie, and I know you guys like the movie, so I don't want to dump on it. But
she's certainly the best thing in the film in terms of acting.
I worry sometimes with so Samara Weaving is the recent example that I'm thinking of, but it happened with like Jocelyn Donahue, where I'm like, she's good. Will she escape the Fantastic Fest bubble?
Sure.
And that's what I'm afraid of with Samara Weaving. And I don't want her to keep doing this type of movie all the time. And I feel bad saying that, but I don't know. I just think, like, the rest of the movie just felt so familiar and, like, kind of made for that Fantastic Fest audience.
It's not trying to break new ground.
I just was restless.
On a personal level, I did, though, like the family member with the crossbow. I liked that actor. But that
Was kind of doing Amy Simons from Your Next.
No, the guy.
The guy who's like Glenn Shandix?
Very
got
much.
Got it.
I like that part, too.
I thought the joke of the daughter was funny, but it's the Amy Simons joke from Your Next, which I will admit, for a lot of Ready or Not, I was like, I want to watch Your Next. I was really thinking about Your Next.
The best review of Your Next I read, I'm sorry, the best review of Ready or Not I read said... It's Your Next crossbred with Clue.
Sure.
Yeah.
I liked that it kind of came out of nowhere. I saw the trailer, a couple months ago, and I was like, I hadn't even heard of this movie. And that I really liked that trailer. I think it's a really good trailer. Mm-hmm. I really want to see this movie. And then I saw it a few more times. But, again, it's small. It's original. It's got a good lead performance. I had enough fun with it that I liked it overall, but not quite to the point of loving it.
Did you guys see Child's Play remake?
I did.
I did too.
I did not.
It's like better than I thought it would be, but also who cares?
Yeah, I guess that's kind of where I'm at. It's like it wasn't horrible, but I also didn't really like it.
Yeah.
I thought there were two good scenes. I thought there were two kill scenes that were pretty spectacular.
Okay.
And I appreciate that they didn't just go beat for beat. Like, remember the original? The original? Let's do that again. They do change it up. Mm-hmm. The whole doll is different. The motivation is different. Everything about it is different. It doesn't make a ton of sense to me that, like, Andy is far too old for this. He's, like, 13 as opposed to, turning 6 or whatever the original Andy was.
Yeah.
Well made enough, but, yeah, who gives a shit?
Yeah, exactly. Like, the thing is, they changed, like... kind of the gimmick with Chucky.
Right.
But also, you're sitting there and you're just like, yeah, but the original gimmick was so much more kind of idiosyncratic and clever and weird.
I really like the original movie.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Because I knew the remake would be disposable. I object to the fact that the picture we took with Joe Bob at Cinepocalypse has that as the background.
Yeah.
And my wife is proficient with Photoshop. I could very well change that background.
Yeah, but it's a time post. So now you'll know that it came out
at some point. Last night we rewatched an episode of The Last Drive-In that we hadn't seen when it was originally shown on the Friday. It's the episode with The Changeling.
Which I never saw because I still haven't seen The Changeling, and that's not how I want to see it for the first time.
And the whole opening is a piece of that lecture he gave.
Oh, okay.
About craft bourbon.
Okay.
And we're watching it, and we're like, this is from How Redneck Saved Hollywood. But that wasn't a bad thing, because we enjoyed that lecture so much, it was interesting to hear another 15-minute piece of it. When is that show going to start up again? Come on, Shudder.
There's no date for it right now.
It became
I'd be surprised if it wasn't October.
It or became they had like our a Friday ritual. It was so much fun. Yeah, yeah. And because you couldn't pause it or record it, everyone was watching it at the same time. That was genius.
I really liked it when they did the first one, the 24-hour marathon. Yeah, and I was going through that for 3 or 4 days. It was good. It was a good time.
So yesterday I went to see Good Boys.
Ah, you're the
Good Boys.
I had a choice between Good Boys and the Bernadette movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Good Boys won the toss. And
that's good, because Adam's still in line for Where'd You Go, Bernadette.
Yeah. They're saving my spot.
What?
It's how we open the show. Forget
I opened
it.
The show by saying I was. You said you were in line for Endgame. I said I was in line for Where'd You Go, Bernadette.
Where's my brain?
This is like the scene in the movie where it took place in the third act, but we put it right at the front.
Good Boys was better than I thought it was going to be.
Okay.
But again, like Bridesmaids, after a while, the crudeness, and I'm not a shrinking violet, just becomes this thing that was added so that this comes out in movie theaters or something. And it's just...
Is it the language or like other crudeness?
Both.
Okay.
But I thought if they got rid of all that stuff, which you can easily do because the three leads are strong, you would have this sort of interesting movie about a time in your life when you're best friends and that time doesn't last forever,
mm-hmm.
which is what the film is really about, all the sex doll stuff and aside. But as it turned out, we're sitting there next to a family where the two girls, I think, are 8 or 9.
Hmm.
Twin daughters
hmm.
of a mom who doesn't quite look like she knows what she's at, and a father who was literally on his cell phone through the whole movie, the entire movie. And I was like, I don't know how I feel about this, because on the surface, I don't think this is appropriate for these girls. They're very, very young. But maybe I'm out of touch, because ultimately I don't think they were hurt by it at all. They seem to enjoy it. After the movie, I overheard them talking to each other, and their conversation was literally sprinkled with the F word.
Really?
So
holy cow.
And I'm not suggesting that this movie,
the movie turned
gave
them into potty
and
mouths.
Maybe that's...
Is the F word fetch? Were they
trying to... Did someone say fetch?
And maybe...
Costner dog pops
and maybe
up.
This is the way 9-year-olds talk to each other now, but I don't know a lot of 9-year-olds, and they're certainly not talking to me that way, so I don't know. That just might be state of the art. The film had one great joke that I was the only one in the theater who enjoyed, because the theater was pretty crowded, and I laughed really loud and could not stop laughing. I could not stop. So to the two twin girls, the joke became this fat guy who can't stop laughing, and they started laughing at me,
oh, wow.
which made other people in the theater.
So you were the glue.
I don't think I'm spoiling anything. One of the boys, his parents are divorcing, and he's taking it really hard, and he's keeping this news from his two friends. So finally we come to the part where he tells them, my parents are getting a divorce. And the one friend who really is very bad with feelings and everything, the first thing he says, part of the joke is the timing, my parents are getting a divorce. And his friend says, what did you do? And because that's the opposite of what you're supposed to do with kids, this isn't about you. It's mom and dad. Right. There's nothing you did. Just the directness of it and just how it's the one thing you're never supposed to say. My parents are getting a divorce. What did you do? I could not stop laughing. I could not stop laughing. But all the stuff about taking Molly and sex dolls and sex swings, and there's a joke about anal beads, which they keep giving.
Yeah, it's in one of the trailers.
And, oh, here's a joke. Those are
anal beads. Red band one.
Here's a joke. Those are anal beads. And guess what? They smell like shit.
That's in the trailer.
Where's the joke?
No, that's the joke.
That's not a joke.
No.
That's what? The audience is congratulating. I know what anal means. I know what that adjective means. I'm so glad I went to the screening I went to, though, because having those two girls sitting next to me changed the entire movie. Now I'm kind of processing it through them and how are they reacting.
Right.
And when it was over, the one girl, the first thing she said was, I really like that.
Huh.
Also, every trailer, they weighed in
on
whether they wanted to see it,
got it,
or go to the movie theater, or wait for it to be. They had that instant, the 9-year-old take, which I think some studio would pay a lot of money for. These girls trailers. Which of these would you? Which of these would you talk your completely disconnected father, your father who has he's checked out years ago, and. You know how distracting that is because no one turns down the brightness.
Yes.
It's like having a flash. I don't think this is just me. It's like having a flashlight in your peripheral vision. He never put it away.
We had the second time we saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, we had former students of Erica's sitting a few seats down from us in the giant empty IMAX theater. And they never shut up. And we didn't feel like we could say something because these were former students. And then we didn't want to move because then they had get a bad impression of this former teacher that they really liked. So we just had to put up with it. But it's, again, they're so terrified and uncomfortable of silence that they can't shut the fuck up and just watch a movie. They're just repeating things back that characters are saying. They're just, they never stop talking.
Which is what we heard a lot about some screenings of Midsommar.
I was at one that happened.
The last, and oh, for Jan wrote a column about it, and so she went back to see it a second time at Streets of Woodfield. And the last 20 minutes, people can't deal with seeing something that is meant to disturb them.
Yeah. Before Midsommar started, it was like right at the end of this couple that was sitting by me. We're talking throughout all the trailers, and I'm just like, okay, well, maybe during the movie they'll be quiet. And then, like, they just kept going and, like, laughing, and they were, like, tickling each other and showing each other, like, you know, stuff on their phone and stuff. And I just turned, and I was just like, I'm not telling you to stop talking, but you can't do it in this theater. Just go outside if you're going to talk, or if you're in here, just please be quiet. And then they were quiet, and I was just like... I was terrified. when I went to see Once Upon a Time, the first, on opening night, I got in my seat, and this guy goes, excuse me, I think you're in my seat. And this was just during the Ad Astra trailer, and I'm like, I'm not. And then he's just like, well, I'm like, check your ticket. And then he's just like, oh, no, I got the other one. I'm like, yeah, that's my thought.
Trust me.
Fucking interrupt
me. Trust
me.
Walk away. Walk away.
Trust me. We know this theater. I almost said something to... checked out dad, but he
could have texted him.
He had a vibe about him that I didn't want to go there. Sir, that's very distracting. Can you put that away? You disrespect me. You disrespect my daughters.
They are good girls, seeing good boys.
What movies have we forgotten?
So we talked about Endgame, didn't we?
Yes,
sort of.
It's
we did a podcast on it.
Yeah,
sort of.
Long Shot, we both liked. Or you liked? Did you like it too?
Very much.
Yeah.
I don't think about it ever.
I don't either.
But at the time, it was like, they so rarely make good romantic comedies.
I was going to say, like The Farewell, but in a completely different genre, it avoided all the pitfalls of shitty Hollywood romantic comedies and actually gave us something you could watch.
I will rewatch it in December to know it goes number 7. Pokemon Detective Pikachu.
Oh, that came out.
That was a good nap.
Oh, boy.
Your son liked that one, boy. He was telling me about it.
It's hard having kids.
Well, he likes Pokemon.
He does, but no that shame is in not this. A good movie.
Brightburn.
It's not what he said.
I did not see Brightburn.
Brightburn made me feel so bad, but it's like kind of impressive how bad it makes you feel. It's very much The Omen. It's just weird. Yeah.
Okay. It just is now hitting like VOD and Redbox and stuff, so I'm going to check it out. But
let me know after you watch it, because there's like an image in Brightburn that is.
Does it have something to do with a jaw?
No.
Okay.
There's one that like has stuck with me, and it's kind of messed me up.
Oh,
a little
boy!
Bit.
All right, now I'm gonna see Brightburn even sooner.
Booksmart. Did we talk about Booksmart?
I mentioned it in passing, but I thought it was really, really good.
I liked it too.
Me too.
It was really funny.
Except for when I saw the trailer for Good Boys right before it, and it was like, it's using the same song.
Yeah.
It's basically the same idea. Yeah, right. Picture this. I'm a bag of dicks.
Mm-hmm. The point in Booksmart when Superior Girl learns that all the people she holds in contempt are also going to great colleges.
Yes.
I really gave the film credit for that.
Yeah.
Because that makes it a very different movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was funny when the girl was like, it's like, oh, you give hand jobs in your car. It's like, yeah, I'm not going to do it in my parents' house. And I was just like, that's an excellent point.
And isn't that girl playing the same character in Good Boys?
Yeah.
It's the same actress.
Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I didn't put that together.
Yeah.
It's this little factory that Seth Rogen has.
She's fake Emma Stone. She's Emma Stone. Like, look at her. She's Emma Stone with brown hair.
All right.
Ma was just, I think it's specifically called Ma because it's just the movie May, if you didn't see May.
I wish Ma was meh.
Yeah.
Which is how you felt about Ma.
I saw it all
Ma?
By
meh.
I saw it all by myself in an empty theater. Shaft was like an incel's wet dream.
How so?
It's just like, fuck you and your PC culture. It was that nonstop. Okay. But even on those terms, I'm like, this just feels like a Brett Ratner movie from 2001.
Okay.
So it's like watchable.
I don't mind Brett Ratner
good.
Movies from 2001.
That's what I meant. It's watchable.
Okay.
Annabelle
that's
Comes
Tim
Home.
Tim Story, right?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Tim Story should do Toy Story 5. Annabelle Comes Home I thought was better than I was expecting it to be.
I have yet to see an Annabelle movie.
I don't want you to start because they're not worth starting. But this
my understanding is they get better as they go along, though.
No,
Creation
like,
is the best.
I don't think two's good. A lot of people
I
like
thought that
two.
Was the best one.
It's like the most mechanical.
Okay,
it's the one that people give 86% on Rotten Tomatoes because they don't know what they're talking
so
about.
So you think the first one's better than the second one?
I think the first one's better than the second one
because
the first one at least is kind of like screwed up a bit. And the second one is very safe. It's very Conjury-ish.
Adam's advice to you about Annabelle is his same advice about meth.
What was
don't start.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, almost a year ago, when we were lucky enough to be able to tour that special effects studio, mm-hmm. ADI, it was the Annabelle doll that he said the studio was very hinky about. So that was the one thing we were not allowed to take pictures with.
The thing I was going to say with Annabelle Comes Home is it's what it gets the tone that Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark wanted to have or should have had.
But it gets it right.
It gets it right. It felt a lot like you remember like when you were a kid and you would go to like a relative or a friend of your parents' house and it's kind of spooky looking and like there's rooms where you're just like someone probably got murdered in there. But it's just your imagination. That it conveys it really well in this movie. It's very got the atmosphere worked for me. Stuber, I thought kind of sucked.
I enjoyed it.
Okay.
I'm a big Camille Nanjiani fan, and I really appreciated how brutal and nasty it was willing to be, considering where it was sort of positioning itself in terms of the trailer and stuff. I'm not saying it's the greatest movie ever made. I recognize that my reaction is really, really personal, but while it was on the screen, I really enjoyed it.
I was happy to see Mira Sorvino again.
I'd be happy to see her again. I didn't see Stuber.
Yeah, she's in it.
I'm in.
Yeah.
I thought compared to a lot of the other stuff I saw this summer, I didn't feel like I had wasted my time or my money. I thought that it had delivered a film.
Yeah. And then The Art of Self-Defense I thought was pretty good. It was like a...
Which you saw at the Critics
Festival. I did.
It was like Indie Fight Club.
Yeah.
But not as ambitious.
Right.
Yeah.
One more thing as we're winding down, because I do not have an encyclopedic knowledge of Apocalypse Now. I remember your famous quote that whenever you put it on and you watch the first 10 minutes of Apocalypse Now, you say to yourself, why am I not always watching Apocalypse Now?
Yeah, the opening convinces me that it's the best movie ever made. But it's
so
not.
Francis Ford Coppola has gone back to the editing bench, and we now have the final cut as opposed to the director's cut or the redo. And someone was just tweeting, there's Twitter again, that the 4K comes out this Tuesday, and because it includes everything, it's 6 discs, and Amazon has it for some crazy price. Mm. So it's like, maybe you'll never watch it, but for $22, you want to have this in your collection.
Oh, crazy cheap. Okay.
I went to see it in the IMAX theater, because I was like, well, I want to see Apocalypse Now in IMAX, and the new cut is very strange. It's not anything like what I thought it was going to be. And again, I had not just previously watched the redo or the original cut, so this is muddled. But if any of you is a terrific, crazy Apocalypse Now fan, put in the comments what you noticed to be the difference between the different cuts. Because the three things I noticed were, the scene in the redo where because they have fuel to give to the party that includes the Playboy bunnies, they get to sleep with them, that's gone again. That wasn't in the original cut. That was in the redo. That's now gone again. The French plantation is still in the movie, although I think it stops the movie dead and the movie was better off without it. And if anything, in this final cut, it seemed longer than it used to be. And the last 20 minutes, again, seems completely different in the way that it's edited, even in terms of separate shots and maybe including some stuff that wasn't in the film. In the new final cut, an effort is really made to show Marlon Brando as little as possible, even more so.
Oh, in the new one?
Yeah, the original. Those are the three things I noticed, but those are completely... personal and off the cuff. If any of you listening to this went to see it or bought the 4K and really can sort of summarize the differences, I'd appreciate reading that in the comment section.
That was a crazy night because I couldn't see anything because I was flying home for a work trip, but I wanted to see Apocalypse Now and I wanted to see Woodstock and I couldn't see either of them.
And I sent Patrick a text. Here are my choices. What do you think? And it was Woodstock for the 50th anniversary, which was one night only. It was Apocalypse Now in IMAX, which I later learned that wasn't the only IMAX screening. That weekend, it showed a couple more times.
Oh, really? It?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Jan and I went to see something else, and on Sunday, it was at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh, shoot.
In the
IMAX.
So
tried to go.
Nicely advertised.
Damn it.
And then also that night was Riff Tracks doing the Giant Spider Invasion.
Well, they play that a few times, though.
There was a rerun on the 20th. So I texted Patrick, and Patrick was like, there's no question, Apocalypse Now in IMAX. So then I think it was Jan who suggested this, or maybe it was me, because I'm devious, and I don't care. I'm 57. Arrest me. That Woodstock is very long, especially now that that has a director's cut that's 4 hours.
Yep.
So I went to see Apocalypse Now in IMAX, and the minute it was finished, I found where Woodstock was and got to see the last hour and a half of Woodstock.
Was anybody in the theater for Woodstock? Because when I was checking the seating charts, because I'm a weirdo who checks seating charts even if he's not seeing the movie, there was like no tickets sold for a lot of them.
Then perhaps the one other guy
okay.
who was in that screening. And when I walked in, he seemed very
mm-hmm.
palpably upset. I kept expecting him to lean over. I was in the row ahead of him. Dude, I was really planning on masturbating during the Jimi Hendrix sequence, and you just blew my plan.
See, I jerk off during Richie Havens. I get out of the way.
But
freedom.
What you're saying is true, he was also a sneak.
Oh.
And maybe he wasn't there from the beginning, and he was doing exactly what I did, but his first movie wasn't
kind
as long
of keeping in the spirit
as Apocalypse
of Woodstock,
Now. Yeah, it's a free concert, man. It's a free concert.
The fence was down.
And that means some people are going to take a bath, man. That's what that means. Some people are going to take a bath.
The concessions people will come in. They're just like, we got to feed them, man. We got to feed them.
But they're putting your well-being above the almighty dollar. Woodstock is so great.
Yeah,
wondering, my wife has a dim view of this. The ad that keeps coming up on Instagram more than any other ad is, when Woodstock was finished, a local senior citizen's home bought the stage lumber to turn it into a racquetball court and a barn. So the concert's over. Someone comes and gets this lumber. They take it over to this old age home where for the last 50 years, it's been a barn and a racquetball court. And then the old age home went out of business. And some wily Woodstock native, some guy who's lived there his whole life, said, is that still there? So he goes there. He finds out still who owns it and buys the wood. And he's selling the Woodstock stage in different configurations. You can get a piece of it in Lucite. You can get a piece of it in a frame with a picture of the crowd and a pretty big piece of the stage. Or you can get this medallion that's a bronze peace sign, and inside the medallion is a round piece of wood that's from the stage.
That's pretty neat.
How
much wood would Woodstock wood?
How much wood would the stage could, if the stage could talk and tell us stories? And so my wife, who doesn't spend money in such a profligate fashion as I, has said, there's no way. I mean, how could you? But it's a convincing story, and it comes with a certificate of authenticity and blah, 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 blah. They also collected all the sawdust from cutting the stage into these different pieces for these different collectibles, and you can get sawdust.
And
in
snort
little,
it. In true Woodstock fashion.
In true Woodstock fashion.
You can smoke this.
The brown sawdust that's making its way around collectors is not particularly too good. Of course, it's your own trip, so be my guest. But that's the news we've received. And all of the sawdust, which they are calling stardust.
Oh.
We are stardust. We are golden. Yeah. We are caught in a devil's bargain. And all of the proceeds from that they're giving to charity.
Nice.
So I want this thing really bad.
How much are they?
Because Woodstock speaks to me. The cheapest of the options is the medallion.
Yeah.
Because it's like a 1-inch round piece of the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's $99.
You gotta do it.
The biggest one presents the stage piece, which is about a 3x3 square, in a Lucite cube that's horizontal, so it actually looks like a stage. And then in the back of the presentation, there's a picture of Jimi Hendrix performing. So if you hold it right, it looks like he's standing on the wood you just bought for $269.
Whoa.
Which is ironic, considering the concert wound up being free.
Right.
But now a piece of the stage will set you back.
Are they selling 35mm trailers of Woodstock?
Not that I'm aware of. So just to later use this as evidence, both of you think this medallion is a good thing.
I have not weighed in on this and refuse to weigh in on this.
I need you to weigh in on this.
I want you to get it just so I can see you wearing a medallion from here on out.
Because I think...
if you'll wear it every day, I say get
it.
This
would be my Wishmaster ring.
Yeah. I hope it doesn't turn your neck green, though.
Green, the color of envy. And this is also, if you've made it this far into the podcast, comment on this Woodstock medallion. Yeah. Comment on whether you think I should buy this damn thing.
And send money.
Yeah, please.
Because it's available in two different finishes, too. The metal part, that's the peace sign, mm-hmm. is available in, like, bronze or pewter.
It'll be like your Tony Stark heart.
The company is called, the company he formed to sell these trinkets is called Peace of the Stage.
I get it.
P-E-A-C-E of the Stage.
Nice. Clever.
Yeah.
Anything left to say about the summer?
I thought it was great. Sorry you guys disagree with me. I thought it was a great summer.
I thought it had highlights.
Yeah. It had peaks and valleys.
Yeah.
I'm happy that it happened, if for no other reason that we got Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Midsommar.
Right. Yeah.
And now we have to start writing our script for a movie we're going to pitch. Werner Herzog as someone's dog.
Vontae Mack, no matter rough.
Thank you guys, as always, for listening. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe in iTunes. Find us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. We're like a month away from Scary Movie Month, so that's
exciting.
Pretty exciting.
And as everyone has noticed, all the stores, I have a theory about this, all the stores are putting out their Halloween stuff early. We've noticed this.
Yeah.
It's all early. Someone in marketing way up high in a big building said, no one is happy. Everyone is in a state of the world sucks. I bet if we put this stuff out early, this would really cheer some people up. People would buy Halloween stuff in August.
They were right. Mm-hmm. Anyway, thank you guys. Thank you guys for doing the show. I always enjoy it a lot.
Yep.
Rough.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.